This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
I would now like to ask tonight's dazzling intellects to come onto the stage, and I'll introduce them formally as they each make their initial contribution. But if you'd say hello to Bruce Petty, Antonio Lanscano, Simon Singh and Rachel Webster. I'm now going to start it all again for the purposes of wireless. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the first session of the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009. And we're here to discuss, or to try and work out, where do big ideas come from? Now, I'm in the privileged position of sitting in a radio studio at night for the last 20 years being bombarded with ideas, but I'm still puzzled by how they happen. There are some, of course, that would argue they're God's gift. There are others who would suggest that they occur spontaneously, like the great idea of life itself. There are some that feel that it requires genius, a solitary genius, to discover them. Others believe that they're just waiting to be discovered, just sitting there like unknown realms, waiting for a boat to bump into them. I have no idea. Some of the great thinkers, some of the people with really large ideas, have been quite modest about their role in them. Freud, for example, insisted that he neither invented nor discovered the unconscious, but simply named it. Newton was similarly modest about his own achievements and said, if I have seen a little further, it is by standing on the shoulder of giants. Then there's the odd thing, isn't there, that things as immense in their implications as the telephone on the one hand or a natural selection on the other are discovered simultaneously on opposite sides of the planet in quite different cultures. So where do the damn things come from? I'm not sure, we probably won't resolve the matter this evening, but let's have a bash with a very distinguished panel. I shall introduce progressively as I ask each of them to make an initial contribution. The first is my oldest living friend, Bruce Petty. I've known Bruce for 55 of my 70 years. We met when we were both young and full of promise. He'd arrived back in Australia having carved a swathe with Punch, Esquire, New Yorker, Lilliput, other magazines that have gone to God. And although his talent as a cartoonist was recognised there, he couldn't get a gig here. And I was reminding Bruce that the two of us, for our sins, made one of the very first television commercials in Australian history. We then expiated guilt by making a documentary on Vietnam called Hearts and Minds. Bruce, of course, went on to win an Oscar, one of the first Australians to so do. His books are remarkable. His films are extraordinary. And he has a special interest in the idea. Bruce is never simply interested in politics. He always looks at underlying ideas. And many of his films and his drawings known as perambulations are attempts to put an idea or to configure an idea, to make it into a machine that you can look at and play with. Bruce Petty is an extraordinarily gifted human being, and I would ask him to be our first contributor and tell us what he thinks about the origin of the idea.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you very much, Philip. I thought I'd mention two kinds of ideas, actually. One is democracy, and the other is the variable speed windscreen wiper. Because one you could say is conceptual, and the other, I think, is sort of practical and functional. And where do they come from? Well, I recall, and you may recall high school 11-year biology, seeing the grey-pink hemisphere of a sheep's brain on the thing. Not all that aesthetic, but in position in a sheep, the sheep's brain is a dazzling bit of apparatus, seems to me. Apply air, water and grass to it, springs to life, a mass of electromagneticism, and it runs a sheep, you know. But the human version started the idea business, as I gather, a couple of billion years ago, from a standing start, could be debated. Cluster of cells in a chemical froth I've got here, bit of solar hit, then a squid, soon a sheep, chimpanzee, then humans, next thing democracy, soon after that the variable speed windscreen wiper, and us here wondering whose big idea it was in the first place, the whole thing. A few observations though, and they're not particularly original, but it's this two-level brain thing that I think is interesting. One part that does the logic bits and one part that analyses stuff. One part that does mechanics and the other part that worries. You could say there's one side of the brain that invents the wheel and another side that questions why wheels are all up one end of town, for instance. Now, on the evidence, I would say the brilliant logic part of the brain is accelerating way ahead of the analysing part. There's a few points suggesting why that is, but...
Well, don't hesitate to make them, Mr. Petty.
Well, one is that we invent faster wheels, but we seem to have slower traffic. You know. Computers get so many answers so quickly, we're so pleased we forgot why we asked in the first place. These are the puzzles that it seems to me technology has left us. But there's just another point. It seems to me that the big, abstract, reflective ideas that seem to be missing seem to me to be triggered by crisis. Like Plato's ideas on justice and republic came out of a terribly, brutally corrupt Athens. Tom Paine, ideas of the common man, came out of the bitter American and French revolutions. UN rights of nations, IMF and the World Bank came out of World War II. Microfinance loans came out of Bangladesh poverty. I mean, do we have to have degrading, inhuman kinds of behaviour before we get humanitarian ideas? And the only other point I want to make is this, that it seems to me that we already have a pretty useful set of big ideas. The thing is, they go wrong. Their operators ignore the operating manual. Good big ideas lose power. Parts fall off, like the compass. Some big ideas that are worse for air, for example, an attempt to giving workers a say in what they did. That was a good idea. In the 30s, wheel wobble, lost steering completely, next thing, fascism. The UN was a big idea, good one. Stabilise a shaken 100 nations with some democracy. Got top heavy, now up 5 countries veto anything it wants to do. The IMF, rationalised world finance, good idea. Then there's a terrible gear grinding in the third world and required, because they were required to open their currencies to the West and balance their budgets regardless. Ask Argentina, ask Kenya, listen to Arundhati Roy. So the IMF needs repair. Human rights, great idea. Then the drive shaft comes loose. Rights to freedom of expression collides with the right to protection against racism. Collisions everywhere. It would seem to me that we already have some big ideas. They all need repair. And what we need to know is where the big idea maintenance is going to come
from. So we don't need new ideas, Bruce. We merely need to make the existing ones work better.
Exactly.
Right.
And the sort of a thing, and just lastly, I think it's a thing we're going to pretty much leave for our children to work out. And our children have no trouble with the digital world. They mastered that. And they know where big ideas come from.
Google.
We must remind them of the other mysterious part of the brain that's about the great adventure of trying to make sense of what we think we know. That would be my suggestion about big ideas.
Thank you, Mr. Petty. Ladies and gentlemen, Bruce Petty. It's funny that you mention the windscreen wiper. I remember the thrilling day came to me at Heathrow when I was going to take a flight on the Concorde. It was the most magnificent looking thing. It was as beautiful in its way as a Gothic cathedral, that elegant white dart. And everything about it was totally unprecedented. But up the front, it had a windscreen wiper. A windscreen wiper for Mark 1.5. So the windscreen wiper works, doesn't it?
They're very important, Philip.
Do we need a huge windscreen wiper for democracy?
I'll think about that. That's a good image.
Okay. Now, my next panelist, my next contributor, is Antonio Lescano. He's a biology professor at the National Independent University in Mexico. And he's also been professor in residence or visiting scientist in France and Spain, Cuba, Switzerland, Russia, the USA, and a couple of local planets in other galaxies. He's currently president of the International Society for the Study of the Origin of Life. A very good idea, I've always said, the origin of life. And he's the first Latin American scientist to hold this position. I have no idea what Antonio wants to say about the idea.
Well, to be sincere, neither do I, but I was thinking when you were mentioning among the great ideas of our times, you were mentioning natural selection. And some people know that at the same time that Darwin had been working for over 20 years or so on the idea of natural selection, all of a sudden the letter came from Wallace, who had independently come to the same idea. And I think it's very important to make the comparison here between science and art. If we had not had Mozart, we would not have Don Giovanni. If we had not had Darwin, nevertheless, the idea of natural selection would have been developed in science. So I think this is
so important. So it was waiting to be discovered by one or more people.
Well, actually, there were more than two people that discovered it. There was a pathetic fellow that... when he read Darwin's Origin of Species, sent him a letter saying, I came with the same idea long before you. And he kept sending letters to him and writing books, which he subtitled Mr. X, I'm not going to say his name. His mother was Australian, in fact. The real discoverer of the idea of natural selection. So what you see here is that at some point you have the social environment and the atmosphere that is quite ready to an idea to mature and develop in science, but not in art. The process of creativity must be somehow the same, whatever goes inside our brain. But the environment, if you are devoted to one aspect or the other, are completely different. Now, one thing that people do not know about Wallace, which I find fascinating myself, is that he came out with the idea of natural selection when he was having a very, very high, very complex attack of fever. He had malaria, and he was lying in a tent in Malaysia, and sweating and high fever and so on, and he woke up and said, a species evolved by natural selection. He brought down the idea, went unconsciously again, and after 3 or 4 days, he developed the idea more properly and sent the letter to Darwin. Now, what was going on in his brain that in the middle of a high fever attack, he could actually come out with, he could articulate the idea of natural selection?
So all of us should get swine flu well, as a matter of urgency.
Coming from Mexico, I will not recommend you to it. But there is another case that is somehow similar to that of Wallace, which is Mendeleev, the gentleman who came with the idea of how to order properly the chemical elements and came out with the periodic table that allows scientists to predict the properties of elements yet to be discovered or fabricated. And he had been obsessed with the problem of ordering the chemical elements. And once he was sitting in his desk, he had an appointment in Moscow. His butler said, Professor, I have to take you to the train station. He said, no, book me in another train. And that went on for a while. Finally, he went to sleep. And all of a sudden he woke up and said, I know exactly how to order the elements in this table. And we still have his notes with the tea that he spilled. He was a Russian, so of course he was drinking tea. He had to, we still have the notes with the tea drops that he spilled when he was frantically working on it in his sleep. And that is not so different either from what happened to Kekulé, who came out with a very clever idea of how to imagine some chemical compounds. He was dreaming, and he woke up and said, I know exactly how to picture these molecules. So
Einstein made the similar point. He talked about the intuitive leap. He'd say, I go to sleep at night and I cannot resolve an issue, but I wake up in the morning and it is there, E equals MC squared or what have you.
But that is if you're a genius, because I go to sleep and I only have nightmares. I don't my dreams never fulfill a major discovery, so you can have it both ways.
But so you see this process of unconsciousness.
Yes.
What Freud might suggest, the subconscious is cogitating all the time.
Absolutely.
And it helps if it's a bit disturbed by fever.
Absolutely, absolutely. Or by other agents that I don't think is legal to mention
public. No. Yes. Well, that's a very interesting input. So where do you put the genius factor? Where do you, clearly, you make the point that even if Wallace and Darwin hadn't been around, that great truth would have finally occurred to someone. But does genius at least expedite the process? Accelerate it?
Clearly so. And you have other examples in science, but the problem is that you don't have the prototypical scientist that you can picture as the kind of scientist that makes major discoveries. You have intelligent scientists, you have eccentric scientists, you have female and male scientists, you have scientists that are very peculiar like Mr. Cavendish, you have scientists that are very outspoken like James Watson. I mean, you have all kind of scientists, but there's some spark, some inner spark. And I know I'm sounding very Platonic, but the spark is there. And that's what's so fascinating.
Excellent. Thank you very much. 10 out of 10 on the koala stand. So we have Bruce, who sees that you really need the hammer of need on the great anvil of pain to produce really big ideas, and he wished it was otherwise. We've got you believing that it's best to go to bed at night with the temperature. And we shall now find out from Simon Singh what Simon says. That was an accidental pun. He's a science writer, broadcaster. He completed his PhD in particle physics at Cambridge, and he then became a megastar at the Beeb's science department. He produced, directed Tomorrow's World, Horizon, and Earth Story. And he made a very famous docker about a very famous mathematical problem. And I understand, Simon, that the book version became the first book on mathematics to top the bestseller lists.
The first and the last. Yes.
And would you explain what it was before you give us your...
Yes. So the story dates back to a 17th century French mathematician, Pierre de Fermat, who was reading an ancient Greek text called the Arithmetica. And in it, he came up with an equation, a bit like Pythagoras' equation, but just slightly different. And he was convinced that this equation had no solutions. No whole numbers would fit into this equation. And not only did he think this was true, he came up with a proof. And he wrote in the margin of the book, I know this proposition is true, I know I can prove it, but I don't have the space to write down the proof. And then he died. For 300 years, everybody wanted to find this proof. And in the end, it was an English mathematician who had dreamed about it since the age of 10.
You mean literally dreamed, thought about it during his dreams?
Quite possibly, yes. So it's also a story about childhood ambition and things like that. So.
More recently, you've done an analysis, a study of alternative medicine. I hope you came down on the side of the skeptics.
Very much so. I mean, by definition, a skeptic is merely someone who thinks about something in a rigorous way. And I co-authored the book with a professor of alternative medicine. And people often think, well, because he's a professor of alternative medicine, he must be in favor of it. To which he points out that if you're a professor of toxicology, that doesn't mean you're in favor of toxins. So we look at it rigorously, and our conclusions are largely negative. But where there's something positive, where the evidence is there, we put that forward as well.
Simon, your initial contribution to the debate, please.
Yes, well, I mean, people often think about great ideas coming out of inspiration or perspiration, and I thought something that you've already hinted at, the role of just luck, of just good fortune, of serendipity, just being in the right place at the right time and discovering a great idea that you weren't even looking for in the first place. And this in science, this is just all over the place. The entire history of science is littered with serendipitous discoveries. And even just in the area of radio astronomy, which we may talk about more this evening, the notion of radio astronomy. So instead of looking at the sky with an optical telescope, let's look at what other radiation might be emitted, X-rays, infrared, ultraviolet, and radio waves. But the notion that space had radio waves and that galaxies emitted radio waves was discovered completely by accident by a chap called Jansky, an American telecommunications engineer, really. He was trying to figure out what the sources of static were in the atmosphere. So he built a giant aerial on a turntable and he rotated it round, and he discovered that some sources of static were coming from distant thunderstorms. Another source of static was just local thunderstorms. But the third source of static just seemed to be coming from the center of our galaxy. And he suddenly realized that the heart of our galaxy is forever throwing out radio waves. And that really gave birth to the idea of radio astronomy, purely by luck. And then there was an English radar engineer called Stanley Hay. And in the Second World War, he was given the job of trying to figure out how the Germans had invented a very clever radar jamming system, because the English radar systems were pointed out to the continent, and they were continually being bombarded by this radio activity, and nobody had a clue as to how the Germans were creating it, this radio jamming noise. And Stanley Hay realized that this radio noise was coming from the east in the morning and coming from the west in the evening. And in fact, it was nothing but the sun that was emitting radio waves. And so again, purely by accident, he discovered that the sun and all the stars in our galaxy and all the stars in the universe emit radio waves profusely, all by accident. And the biggest and greatest accidental discovery in radio astronomy probably happened in the 1960s. In the 1960s, there was a big debate as to whether the universe started with a big bang or whether the universe had just been here forever. And the key test, one of the great skeptics was a guy called Fritz Vicky. Fritz Vicky was a real skeptic of the Big Bang theory and really hated it. And one of the insults he had for people who believed in the Big Bang was a spherical bastard. And by that he meant a sphere is a geometrical object which looks the same whichever way you look at it. And a spherical bastard is someone who's a bastard whichever way you look at them. And so you had people like him criticizing the Big Bang, and people like Georges Lemaître proposing the Big Bang. But the key test was radio waves. If there was a Big Bang, there should be a blast of radiation, and that radiation should still be here today in the form of radio waves. Find the radio waves, and you know there was a Big Bang, or microwaves, which are a type of radio wave. But people forgot about this prediction because nobody could really measure microwaves or radio waves from outer space when this idea was proposed in the 1940s in sufficient detail to pick up these things. And then in 1965, there were two guys. Again, communications was what this emerged out of. There was a radio telescope that was being built, and two radio astronomers decided to look at the radio waves from galaxies. They pointed their radio telescope, a giant horn antenna, they pointed it up at the sky. Before pointing it at a galaxy, to measure the radio waves from galaxies, they pointed it at a bit of space where there was nothing. And they got radio waves and microwaves. And they were annoyed, so they pointed it somewhere else. They got radio waves and microwaves. They waited 24 hours. They still got microwaves. Wherever, whenever they pointed this darn telescope, they were getting microwaves. And they started looking inside to see what was wrong. And inside the telescope, they found that there were two pigeons that were nesting there. And the pigeons had deposited what they diplomatically call a white dielectric material. So they cleaned out the telescope, but still these microwaves kept on coming. And eventually, they kept on moaning to their colleagues and going to conferences and complaining. And eventually, somebody pointed out to them that what they discovered was the microwave radiation left over from the Big Bang. There was no other way to explain this radiation except in the context of the Big Bang. It was exactly what the Big Bang would expect. So purely by accident, Penzias and Wilson were the two radio astronomers in question. Purely by accident, they had made arguably the greatest discovery in the history of astronomy. And in due course, they were awarded the Nobel Prize. Now, some people will say, you shouldn't get the Nobel Prize for just making a lucky discovery. But the likelihood is that other radio astronomers had also picked up this radio signal, but just ignored it. Because it's so weak and feeble, you can probably get on with what you want to do. So it was their persistence and dedication that really allowed them to turn that lucky discovery into something that was meaningful. Churchill once said something along the lines of, you know, often we stumble on the truth, but only the truly wise are smart enough to recognize when that happens. My favorite quotation, though, my favorite description of serendipity, and I'll maybe finish with this, favorite definition of serendipity is looking for a needle in a haystack and finding the farmer's wife. So that's possibly what Penzias and Wilson did.
On that provocative note, it's time for me to... to identify what's happening and why it's happening. Well, what's happening is the Festival of Ideas. It's happening at the Elder Hall in Adelaide. It's going out on a certain wireless program across Australia and the wider world. And my guests on stage are Bruce Petty, Antonio Lascano, the aforementioned Simon Singh and his pigeon, and now Rachel Webster. But before I go to you, Rachel, I want to come back briefly to the serendipitous notion. I work at the Centre for the Mind at Sydney University, or work with the centre, and it's run by a Woody Allen lookalike, an American scientist called Alan Snyder. Alan, by studying the eye of a fly, you know, the multi-lensed eye of the fly, happened upon the mechanism that would make it possible to get information in and out of the fibre optic tube. Now, I put this to you, that very often a discovery is made by a scientist outside his area of expertise.
Yeah, I think this has happened, it's happened for centuries when maybe these divisions didn't occur, when you had Renaissance scientists who dipped into everything. But now it's becoming more common again with interdisciplinary centres being set up deliberately to bring together diverse groups of researchers. And it happens on a small scale. Places like the Newton Institute bring together... It's a Newton Institute in Cambridge which is devoted to maths. But maths in itself can become such a specialised area that bringing together different mathematicians from different areas is a radical idea, a radical thing to do. And the Santa Fe Institute in America brings together economists to talk to chaos theorists, to talk to engineers and so on.
Malcolm Gladwell has been writing about this approach, hasn't he, in New Yorker lately?
Yeah, it's something which I think in the last 15 or 20 years has become fashionable, and the importance of this idea of diversification as opposed to specialisation is being recognised.
My next guest is someone who decided to specialise at a very early age. When we were sitting backstage, Rachel Webster was telling me that, like St. Joan hearing her voices, she heard voices saying, go forth and be a mathematician. These days, she's Professor Astrophysics, University of Melbourne, and she chairs the National Committee of Astronomy. Now, she's clearly a role model to young women, and we need more young women in science. But when she's not role modelling, she's leading the campaign to have a billion-dollar square array telescope built in Outback WA. And that's a mistake, because you should be building it here in South Australia, but we'll forgive you. And how's that project going?
Well, it's going extremely well. And I should say that I'm one of a number of scientists who are involved in that project. So to call me the leader, I think, would be...
I can call you the leader if I like.
Please do.
Rachel, your contribution to this fascinating discussion on the nature of the idea.
Well, one of the disadvantages, of course, of running fourth in the line is that a lot of the great ideas have been picked up already. But there were two points that I wanted to talk about. The first one is really directly addressing the idea of where big ideas come from. And I think it's quite tempting to think of the hard sciences, physics, astrophysics, as being very logical. And so presumably the big ideas come from a logical sequence of thought. But in my experience, that's absolutely not the case. And just as we've heard already, in fact, what happens is that an individual sees a conundrum, a problem, and they make a leap to the answer. And the leap is based in very deep intuition. And once they've got there, and usually they're pretty persuasive and pretty strong that this is the right answer, but then the ladder of logic is built to that idea, and you know, maybe it takes off. And the people who do this are actually pretty rare beasts, so it's not everybody. There are a lot of people who are the people who fill in the ladder and do the computations and all the rest of it. These rare people indeed are geniuses in the sense that you would normally think of it. But the second point that I wanted to make takes off from that point. And in fact, I wanted to talk about the development of an idea. So, you know, at one level, ideas are kind of cheap. You can, you know, get out of bed in the morning and have one for breakfast. One might come in the shower. But it's actually the development of the great ideas that is really important. And the example I wanted to use was, in fact, Fritz Zwicky, who's already come up today. And Fritz was a remarkable astrophysicist. He lived... he was working strongly in the 1930s. He understood things about the universe that have really only come to be appreciated 40, 50, 60 years on. So some of you may have heard of dark matter, which... is stuff in the universe that's maybe six or eight times more... there's six or eight times more of it than there is of the stuff that we're made of. So, you know, it's pretty important. We still don't know what it is. But anyway, Fritz worked out that this stuff was around 70 years ago. Now, and he did a whole bunch of other stuff as well, so it wasn't just dark matter. But he was an irascible fellow. And Simon has already... quoted one of his most famous sayings about the spherical bastards, which I was also going to quote. But I have something else that I wanted to read to you because it's important to understand just what sort of fellow he was. And he wrote some of these great things down. He didn't just say them. So in one of his famous catalogues, he wrote the following. He said of his colleagues, they are scatterbrains, sycophants, and plain thieves, who have not love for any of the lone wolves, who are not fawners or apple polishers. They doctor their observational data to hide their shortcomings and to make the majority of astronomers accept and believe in some of their most prejudicial and erroneous presentations and interpretations of facts, and therefore publish useless trash in the bulging astronomical journals. Now, that's pretty strong stuff to put in print in the front of a catalogue, a science catalogue. And there's plenty more examples like this. But the point here is that in the 30s, the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, when Fritz was active, he was so abusive of the modest attempts of other people that nobody else essentially worked in the area of cosmology. All the young people were too terrified to work there. And so the area of cosmology essentially stopped until after he died, which was around the time that the cosmic microwave background was discovered, in the mid-60s. He lived a little longer than that. And so the point I wanted to make was, yes, he was a genius. There was absolutely no question about it. But he managed single-handedly to stop cosmology for 40 years by being so offensive to anybody else who ventured into the area. And so I think, you know, the question of ideas and genius is one part of the equation. But the ability to develop and foster and nurture the ideas is another crucial part that you can't ignore.
Rachel, that's wonderful. Thank you for that. Ladies and gentlemen, Rachel. Mm. I want to pick up on the idea of a bullying scientist being, in effect, anti-ideas, and relating it to a problem that I know you have had, Antonio, lately. It's certainly been a major problem in the United States, but I know it's filtered down into Central America. And that is the people who fight ideas so tenaciously. And I'm thinking of the creationists and the intelligent designers, given backing, of course, right out of the White House by George Bush. This has actually affected the quality of science education.
In the United States, but not in Mexico. One thing that many people don't realize is that countries that have, or societies that have a Catholic background, do not have a problem with evolution. Because they don't have the literal reading of the Bible that you see among the creationists and intelligent
designers. They had a bit of a worry with Galileo, but not so much with Darwin.
Indeed. The other point that I think is very important is that one should not confuse the creationist and intelligent design movement neither as a religious movement or as a scientific movement. I think it's a political movement. I think that there we are seeing the expression of a very highly conservative middle-class mentality typical of the white American Anglo-Saxon Protestants. It's a very WASPy idea. But it's an idea that, as you said, is spreading throughout the continent. And I have been very concerned about this. And there are about 140,000 preachers from American churches. They are actually going throughout Latin America. And they don't represent the most intellectually sophisticated groups. To put it mildly. It's also true, and that's something that has to be kept in mind, that among Protestants, you also see very, very highly developed cultural traditions, like among the Anglican churches. Mm. You can sometimes read commentaries made by the Bishop of Cambridge or our Bishop of Cambridge. I'm not so keen on those categories myself. In Nature or Science, which are very respected journals. And you are talking with a colleague, clearly. Mm-hmm. I just spent the entire month of June working at the secret archives of the Vatican, which are not so secret, they're not so archives. If you are a scholar, you have the right to go there.
Did you put in a good word for Mary MacKillop?
Well, actually, I wasn't aware that she was such a saintly figure. I have to say that. I was not aware of her miracles until I came here. But there you can speak with people. They're mostly from the Jesuits or the Dominicans. Yeah. They're people that have PhDs in physics or sociology or mathematics.
Well, the Jesuits were the great scholars on earthquakes, weren't they?
Among other things, yeah. Remember the Lisbon earthquake,
yeah,
right,
absolutely.
And Candide, yeah.
Bruce, you are an artist. Your kids work in the film business. You're married to one of the great Australian novelists. Let's look at creative ideas as opposed to scientific ideas. Where do yours come from? Do you go to sleep with fever and wake up in the morning suddenly seeing a wonderful drawing sitting in front of you? Does your wife, in fact... where do they come from?
Well, personally, as a cartoonist, they're all established by politicians who will never get it right. So we just draw them getting it wrong, which they do
right.
Pretty regularly. So there's a formula there. my particular area of creativity is a bit mechanistic, quite honestly. But I do think the art world has got something to do with creativity. I'm not sure how it operates, but somehow the idea of being confronted by an image that is something you have never seen before must push your head around a bit, must put some neurons into a different part of your brain. A bit of music you've never heard before, a chain of words that is absolutely unique and creative and aesthetic. Things you can't really describe, but they move people. That's territory that I think has got something to do with science and creativity and imagination. I can't say that every good artist has a great creative mind in the sense of politics or imagining solutions to the global warming or anything.
But in a sense, Guernica was a great political cartoon, wasn't it?
Guernica was, and it's something to do with the timing. I mean, he was painting at the time when there was brutality all around his country, and that's what I think I was suggesting before. Somehow the context of your particular endeavours has got something to do with whether it's going to be really imaginative or not. And I think it's a bit of a problem in a very benign country like ours. Do we have to wait for some crisis before we get imaginative?
I did 12 television programs and 2 books with Paul Davies, who, of course, was a professor here in South Australia after he fled the Thatcher regime. And we filmed them in South Australia. And at the end of them, I was none the wiser. I remember once Paul said to me, driving back from a radio program we did together, there are only 3 people on earth who really understand what I'm on about, and I clearly wasn't one of them. And after a long time with Paul, I remain in that dilemma. The problem I have, and I put this to you, Simon, because you, as someone who tries to educate a wider world on the mysteries and magical, almost magical nature of science, the problem I have is that so much of the great science is almost entirely counterintuitive. In other words, it goes against the sort of logic that we seem to be hardwired with and requires topsy-turvy land.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Einstein said something along the lines of common sense is just a set of prejudices we have by the age of 18. And science is about overcoming those prejudices and that common sense and seeing the world as it really is. It's sort of the wonder and the weirdness of science that attracts so many young people into it. I'm not a great fan of science fiction, but I know that lots of young people, teenagers, get hooked on science fiction, the ideas of time travel and teleportation and multiverses and parallel dimensions, and those mind-bending concepts are what excites them enough to then pursue science at a later stage. And then to find out those mind-bending science fiction ideas that aren't so much science fiction but actually can be part of the bedrock of science in the years to come, perhaps. And so the ideas are mind-bending enough and completely counterintuitive. And then the next barrier, I think if we want to understand science and appreciate science and be interested in it, we just have to go along with the ride. If we want to do science, we then have to get to grips with the complex mathematics and the abstract world of mathematics and the complexities of having to do scientific experiments, which may take years and years of dedication. So only a few are chosen to go on that ride. I desperately wanted to be a physicist when I was a child and did a degree and did a PhD and always thought that's what I'd try and be, was be a particle physicist. But when I got to my mid-20s, I could see people around me who were that much smarter and that much quicker. And I thought, well, rather than being a second-rate scientist, I'll move out. And the next best thing to being a scientist for me was the opportunity to write about science, and that's what I did. But although I think few people can be scientists, I think most people can appreciate science and understand the broad brushstrokes of these great ideas to a large extent.
Look, I'm going to ask you a very personal question, and it won't go outside this room.
Right.
No one here will repeat what you say.
Okay.
And this part will not go out on the radio program. He lied smoothly. When you look at the counterintuitive world of, say, quantum mechanics, and I think it's there that it becomes most mind-bending, do you really understand it?
Yes, I think so. I mean, Feynman, I think Richard Feynman, or maybe other people said, if you think you understand quantum mechanics, then you clearly don't. and that's true that, I understand how to do the calculations, I understand the implications of it. The philosophy of it is truly, truly mind-bending, and that's where physicists become completely befuddled and let the philosophers take over. So there's a bedrock of quantum physics, which is, I think, beyond even physicists. Where I became really confused was in Fermat's Last Theorem. The proof there is... Well, the fact that nobody discovered it for 300 years is testament to its difficulty. In order to create this proof, which ran to 200 pages, Andrew Wiles had to draw on all of the most complex ideas in 20th century maths, as well as inventing his own ideas. So when I tried to, when I made a TV program about it, I understood the stepping stones of the proof enough to be able to convey the basic ideas in a TV documentary. When I wrote a book, I went back to all the people I interviewed and read into it more deeply and understood some of the gaps between the stepping stones. I then read a new Scientific American article about it with Professor Ken Ribbett and understood it in a bit more detail. But I think at that stage, going back 10 years... There were only a dozen people who really, really understood the proof in any detail, and I certainly wasn't one of them. So,
Rachel, I'm going to put a similar question to you. We now are persuaded, I believe, on balance about Big Bang. There's not a person, I think I speak for everyone in the hall, perhaps I don't, but say 90% of us, who can imagine the quandary of what happens before the Big Bang. You know, we can feel our neurons and synapses sort of collapsing into cold porridge. Do you really understand what was going on before?
No.
I love you, Rachel.
No, I mean, and I think the philosophical ideas that we've talked about here, I mean, to go back beyond that, in fact, is a philosophical leap in any real sense. I think you can possibly construct a mathematical theory, but in any real sense, you can't know what goes on before the Big Bang. And
so the very biggest of ideas are still very, very hard for even well-educated, fairly bright human beings to comprehend.
Absolutely, yes.
That's good, though, isn't it?
Well, that's what makes it so exciting.
I live in dread of some smart-ass coming up with a theory of everything and jotting down this piss-elegant equation on a blackboard, and that's all over. I'd hate that to happen.
I actually don't think that's the nature of the world we live in. My personal understanding of what happens is that we open a door, understand what's behind it, and there's another three or four doors there that just turn what we just understood on its head.
What do you think about this, Simon? Are we getting ever closer?
I was involved in a panel last week in London with Martin Rees and Neil Turok, the Astronomer Royal and one of the foremost cosmologists of our time. And Martin Rees, raises the possibility of we may not be smart enough to get to the bottom of it all. Neil Turok is much more optimistic. And he really does look at what might have happened before the Big Bang, whether our universe was created out of the clashing together of sort of two other universes, or whether our universe was
spawned. Infinite recession, perhaps.
Yeah, that sort of thing. And what I was chatting to Neil Turok, as I say, one of the foremost cosmologists of our age. And it turned out that he had the same primary school teacher as Andrew Wiles, who proved Fermat's Last Theorem. That's one hell of a primary school teacher. Turns out these world-class scholars in such diverse fields.
Bruce,
that's where big ideas come from, primary school teachers.
Bruce, when you and I first met... When you and I first met a few lifetimes ago, we were separated by a disagreement on one big idea, and that was my atheism, and at the time, your quite strong convictions about religion, the big idea of God. Mm. Can I ask you now where you are with that big idea?
I didn't think I'd get away with it without a question like that. No, well, there was. My family were religious, and so I was. And that's where you met, you went to socials at church and you met people, girls and people. And, but I was also religious and must have conveyed it to you. But and then I got read a different sort of book and got ferociously secular and scientific. Science has got all the answers. And now... And now I've read some of the books that Simon probably written, I don't know, but, and I read them and I get to the point where they're talking about consciousness and they're going to describe consciousness, how it works. You know, I can understand the windscreen wiper stuff, you know, because you can see it and there's logic and a bit of astronomy that Rachel talked about. But consciousness, how you're aware that you're a person, how you know... You know, you exist, and you read the book, and it gets into quantum physics pretty quick. It says we've got to get to another level of interchange of electromagnetic zooming about. Then they mention bosons and muons, and they tell you that a boson can be in two places at once.
Yes, I know.
And then that's when I stop.
Yes. So, and that's where we stop at the moment. Ladies and gentlemen, this... conversation is going to continue here in Elder Hall, but Late Night Live must take its must pack up and go home. So I will now wind up the broadcast part of the evening by asking you, ladies and gentlemen, to thank these extraordinary people, Bruce Petty, Antonio Lanscano, Simon Singh and Rachel Webster. And thus ends the first part of the Adelaide Festival of Ideas for 2009. Late Night Live, back with you tomorrow. See you then. Okay, now I've done... I'm sorry for that, okay, but... what I want to do now is open this to the audience. Now, I believe that there are any number of microphones on stands. Yes, is there one up in the gods? Yes, there is, and there's one central here. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, would you be kind enough to go to the microphones and vent your spleen? Aren't super bright people nice? I mean, this is what astonishes me. They're so delightful. We're stupid people, aren't in my experience, but that's a... Madam... No, you're fine. You're. We can hear you. Whoops.
Where do big ideas come from? I'm a housewife from Albury, Wodonga, and I had the most incredible experience a couple of years ago. I had various bits of knowledge in my head, millions of bits of knowledge, and I was sweeping the back veranda, sweeping away, and all of a sudden, a most incredible, stunning thing happened. Two bits of separate information. One was about the big desalination plant going in for Roxbury Downs at Whyalla. Why does a housewife think about that? Well, it was just a bit of knowledge. The other bit of knowledge was about the Antarctic Circumpolar Current. Why did I have that bit of knowledge? a bit of knowledge amongst all the knowledge about how to sweep the floor and all
I,
other
I think
bits
we must establish straw broom or...
A straw broom.
Straw broom, right.
All of a sudden, those two bits of information came together in a startling revelation of solving the problem of the saline solution from the desal plant up in Spencer's Gulf there. I won't go into it, but it was startling. I know I stood there for a minute with my jaw hanging open, sort of.
So you're advocating sweeping. This is a... The Buddhists do this.
It was.
The
so
Buddhists
I...
say, when you are sweeping, know that you are sweeping. It's a...
So I stood there for a few minutes, and then I thought, now, come on, come back down to earth, finish sweeping the veranda. So I finished sweeping the veranda, then I went inside and had a cup of tea, you know. I sat down and thought about it. And it was the more I thought about it, I thought, by golly, that's a brilliant idea. So I've been pushing it for the last couple of years. It's got its faults, no doubt, but it
and
also has...
none of us will forget the fact that you told us about it tonight.
Indeed.
In 10 or 20
so
years, when the world's problems are solved, we know that where it came from.
Two disparate bits of information, all of a sudden, for no unknown reason, came together to solve a problem. It was just miraculous. Thank you.
And you tell the story beautifully. Thank you very much. I can't quite... Yes, upstairs, ladies and gentlemen, there's...
Hello. Thank you very much for coming tonight. The last few hundred years was... since we started questioning things, we've discovered more about human nature, who we are, where we're going. Darwin's big idea was a blow to a lot of people about where we come from. But my question is, are there questions and great ideas that maybe we shouldn't have? Are there things that we'll find out about ourselves in the future that will be no coming back from?
This is like the Garden of Eden proposition.
Yeah.
Isn't it, really?
Sort of.
Yeah. What do you reckon? Are there things we shouldn't want to know? Things we would be better off not knowing?
Well, I was very disappointed to find out the truth about Santa Claus. But other than
I'm
that...
I'm sorry, I just had to tell you.
No, I think that truth can never be hidden for long. For sure. And whatever the truth is, we must face it. Now, it's also... a fact that what truth means varies in time and in different environments, social environments. So that's something to be kept in mind.
Mm. There are lots of things I wish I didn't know. What do you think about this, Bruce? Are there areas?
Well, we certainly devise things we shouldn't have devised, like cluster bombs. Don't think we needed them, nor should we have agreed to drop them on anybody. So there's that territory, but you should know how to do it. You should know enough to say we're not going to proceed this direction. That'd be my feeling about it.
Simon, are there things you wish you didn't know or that humanity didn't know?
I just think it's an unavoidable situation that once truths emerge, they're there. Oliver Wendell Holmes, I think, was an American politician, doctor, and he said, you know, the truth is a football. You know, you can kick it around for as long as you like, and it still remains round. That's the beauty of truth. You can poke it and punch it and pull it and push it, but if it's true, it still remains true. And you only need to come up with that idea once, and it's there forever. The truth has to be discovered, but only lies are invented. And once something's been said and it's a lie, well then you can disprove it and eventually it'll go away, but unfortunately with truth, like it or not, is always going to be here to stay.
One of the great appalling discoveries that humans had to concede is that evil wasn't something external, it wasn't something embodied in the devil, it was within us, and boy, we've demonstrated that with enormous enthusiasm for the last few hundred years in particular. And I know quite a few of the people that worked on the bomb at Los Alamos were, in a sense, regretful that they're in the position to do so. It was the great paradox of the most dangerous of knowledge. Anything you know that you wish you didn't? Rachel?
Well, possibly. But I think the question really needs to be turned around another way, which is to say, if there are things that shouldn't be known, who on earth is going to determine that? And I think that's there is no one who can do that. And so we should be quite free to explore whatever we want to explore.
I think we could ask Frank Fenner. He could always tell us. Ladies and gentlemen, is there another question? Yes.
Hello, my name's Shelley Dunstone. Last year we had the federal government's 2020 summit. The purpose of that was to bring together 1,000 of the best and brightest people in the nation to brainstorm some ideas to fix up the country. It seemed to me that the outcome from that summit wasn't particularly startling, a lot of fairly predictable ideas. And I'm wondering whether any of the members of the panel are familiar with that event and followed how that was designed, the process that was applied, and have an opinion on that. For example, all the participants were asked to come along with their best idea, which would seem to me to be a recipe for a whole lot of entrenched positions rather than genuine brainstorming. Do any of the panellists have a view?
Well, I was there, so I should have some response to it. I think it was a huge stunt, and I think most of us who were there were aware that it was. Having said that, it was still fun to be there. And the quality varied from, depending which stream you were in. There are a whole variety of streams. Some of the streams I thought were hopeless, and others were really quite energetic. But all of them, in fact, were there, I think, to produce ideas that Kevin wanted. And that was mandatory, in a way. And the mechanism was such that the ministers who came into the groups and the minders, to a large extent, made that happen.
So, excuse me, I'm just wondering whether any of the panellists have a view as to how an event like that ought to be arranged.
Well, I think you were talking about these experiments where you bring people together from disparate backgrounds rather than put them in streams, which is what happened in 2020, but you put people from different skills, different mindsets, and let them go.
Yeah, but maybe that's the easy part, that brainstorming and putting clever people together in a room to come up with ways of tackling climate change is kind of the easy part. The really difficult part, and where the really big ideas are needed, is how to implement those on a national scale. And that's where the politicians
too, Rachel,
need to be smart to bring us truths which may be unpalatable, or to bring in taxes which may not be popular. And how we tackle that situation, how we get the good ideas implemented on the ground, is the really tricky thing.
Has Mexico tried having sort of huge-scale jamborees for the intellect?
Mexico is like France in the sense that intellectuals play a role in society. I have to confess that I do not know enough of Australia to see if the situation is equivalent, but we do share it. The intellectual is a public figure that can come up with big ideas. But then, as Rachel was mentioning, you have the problem, how do you implement those ideas? Bruce just mentioned one of the most horrendous things that can happen, which are these type of bombs. We know exactly how to stop producing them, and how can you cope with all the economical, political, ideological forces driving the development of even more evil kinds of weapons. So it's not only the idea as such, it's also how do you cope with the actual socio-political situation.
The idea of vaccination was a big idea and a brilliant idea, an idea that saved millions of lives around the world. And yet today, in many parts of the world, and certainly in the UK, vaccination rates are declining. So the big idea of vaccination is there, and the opportunity to save lives and improve health is there. But political wrangling, sensationalism in the media, scare stories on the internet undermine the good ideas. And evolution, great idea, being undermined in this same sort of approach.
Bruce, going back to your cluster bombs. Just before he died, I interviewed Kurt Vonnegut, who was in Dresden, as you know, for the firebombing. And there's a wonderful image in the novel where he runs it backwards in his mind. So the planes fly over Dresden, suck the flames into bombs. The bombs then fly up into the bellies of the aircraft. The planes then fly backwards to England, land on the airstrips. The bombs are taken out, deconstructed, and they finish up being put back in the mines as chemical components. That's the other problem that about the Eden problem, isn't it? That once these things are in play, God, it's hard to get rid of them.
But I agree. I think that's fascinating, and we should. That's art. That's an art input, I think. But my thought on that 2020 thing, we just ask the wrong people. I mean, asking one another, you know, Australia, top Western country, most privileged country in the world, to solve a problem, which I think is still going to be equity. It's the big problem is still how to share out the planet fairly with one another, because if we don't get that right soon, global warming or whatever, these third world is not going to wait much longer. So I think we don't ask one another about a question of equity because we're not going to answer it properly. You ask people in Chile, you ask people in Bangladesh, and they have universities in these places. Are they not? Mexico, full of universities. Brazil is. These are the people that have got a real problem, a global problem, the one that I think we should have answered at that 2020 thing. So I would never expect a 2020 in a country like this to do more than circle round what we've circled round without ever coming to a proper answer.
I asked readers of McCollum to send in ideas, so it wasn't, I thought I'd take some down. I got thousands and thousands of letters, but I have to say the quality of ideas from that larger circle was no better than the quality of ideas from the inner sanctum that went to Canberra.
But can I just ask a question? So climate change is a big idea, and tackling it is something that's essential, and yet a significant fraction of the world, educated world, still doesn't get the idea or get the need that something needs to be done. And yet I heard the Premier earlier today say that the goal was to have 30% of South Australia's energy from renewables by 2020. And in fact, you were going to reach this target 7 years ahead of time. And I guess there's some level of pain associated with changing our energy policy in South Australia. So what makes people here so far-sighted to be able to take a big idea like that and run with it?
This place has run with big ideas for a long time. It's an extraordinary state. You know, votes for women again and again and again. South Australia were light years ahead of the rest of the nation. There's lots of theories why it's so. I don't know. But I have to say, I took this idea of the Festival of Ideas and planted it in other states. But this one works best. And I don't know what it is. It's something in the foul-tasting water. But South Australians love ideas, and I think it's reflected in their politics. It certainly was with Don Dunstan. Another question, please.
Thank you very much.
If indeed, as the whole panel appears to agree, that most big ideas and discoveries in science arise from dreams, serendipity, intuition.
Pigeons.
Indeed, why on earth governments, funding agencies, insist and persist in expecting scientists and researchers to tell them what they're going to discover in 5 years?
That's a question for an expert. You'd understand this process.
Yeah, I suffered this process, actually. But I think that for a very simple reason, the moment someone becomes a bureaucrat, forget about the dreams, forget about the genius, forget about the illusions, you are framing to a very rigid structure, and if you lose your liberty. For me, not a dream but a nightmare will be actually to become a member of the scientific administration in my own country. I will lose freedom. I will lose illusion. I will lose...
Though you could do good things.
I doubt it. I very much doubt it. Bureaucracy is probably the only entity that violates the second law of thermodynamics. It creates itself out of nothing and expands constantly. I mean...
That's a bleak and devastating. What do you think, Simon? Are you as bleak as he is?
It's a balance between, you know, if it looks like the answer is over here, that's where you've got to put most of your funding. If that's where all the hard work and the research and the smart money is over here, you've got to fund it. But you've also got to have a little bit of money over here for the mavericks and the weirdos and the people that just are headstrong, in case the idea just happens to be there. And it's just having that balance of funding. There was something you mentioned earlier. What was it? About being able to take ideas when you've got somebody who's a dictator like Fritz Ficky was, and you scare off everybody from even having a new or fresh idea, that's clearly terrible. And I think Jared Diamond wrote about this in the context of China. China was such a vibrant scientific society for centuries, and then suddenly innovation moved to Europe and the West, and why was that? And Jared Diamond's speculation is that China became this giant empire. And if you had a good idea and the emperor didn't like it, you had nowhere else to go. Whereas someone like Christopher Columbus wants to sail to this weird place, maybe America. If the Italians don't like it, he takes it to Germany. If Germany doesn't like it, he takes it to Spain. But eventually somebody somewhere will give you the money. And you just need that same bureaucracy which has the flexibility within it to nurture fresh talent. And although these ideas emerge serendipitously and out of dreams, they also come after tremendous effort and hard work and dedication. So again, it's that flexibility of having time to focus with intensity as well as that time to just relax and let the intuition take over.
I really have no expertise on science and education, but I was involved in a remarkable moment in Australia where we managed to create a film industry in about 10 seconds flat. We didn't have one. We used to have one. It had been wiped out by the Americans. And I managed to persuade one of a rapid succession of prime ministers, a guy called John Gordon, ostensibly a conservative but in many ways a radical, to set up a little tiny thing called the Experimental Film Fund. And we just gave money. Government money was given. There was no bureaucracy. Anyone who wanted some, we just gave it to them. Not a lot. Couple of hundred thousand, $2,000. And out of that sprinkling of bread upon the water, came a whole generation of quite extraordinarily gifted filmmakers, and we went from nothing to being the darling of the festival circuit within 5 years. But it was randomness. It was the admission. One of the things I discovered was that if you got a very good, beautiful proposal that bureaucrats liked, you know, on an IBM Selectric, impeccably done, it'd be a really crappy idea. But a thumbnail dipped in tar on a piece of brown paper would often produce a terrific movie. Why can't that sort of approach be applied in science?
Give us a lot of money and it will be.
But we didn't have a lot of money.
But the problem is that scientists and artists just don't get it. We just don't know how to play the game that the politicians and the bureaucrats like, and who are, we were debating earlier on about PowerPoint. I love PowerPoint, but
he wanted to do a PowerPoint, and I said, it's bloody radio.
But it's one of those things that bureaucrats and politicians love PowerPoint, and they love flashy stuff and so on. And scientists will just stand up with overhead slides written with runny ink. Because they know the idea is great, and that's the important thing, content over style.
But we just don't know how to play the other game yet. And maybe nor should we, perhaps.
A question from above.
Yes, Simon, you said that that there was a teacher, a primary school teacher, that produced two brilliant minds of the century. Do you find it rather interesting that we live in a world where educational funding goes to the point where at Oxford you can get a one-on-one teaching ratio, and yet in a primary school you can have 35 students in one classroom? If we're talking about creating new ideas, shouldn't we be looking at that teacher that you talked about and find out exactly what they were doing, investigate what they did to create those minds, and try and replicate that pedagogy around the world?
I think it all does come back to education of school children. If we want to have brilliant ideas, we have to teach our children to think creatively and brilliantly and logically and all of those things. And in Britain, I'd be tempted to say that we're going in a negative direction. I was worried about the teaching of science. Fewer kids are taking up science than ever before. The number of people doing A-level science, which is sort of the standard science qualification at the age of 18, the number of A-level physicists has dropped by 50% since I did it. At a time when physics is more relevant, more interesting, more exciting than ever before, we're rapidly declining. So I went to
school. Surely it's also sexier in many ways than ever before.
Yeah, it is.
The fuss that is made of the scientists.
It should be the most amazing thing in the world, and yet children aren't interested. My theory is that it's the way it's being taught. So I went to school for just a term, just to teach A-level physics, just to see what the curriculum was like, what the teachers were up against. Not a single child in the entire school was going to do A-level physics. Now, this was a Church of England school, so it was relatively, faith schools are thought of positively in England. It was a science specialist college, which is just a meaningless label, which is just spin, because there was nothing special about the science in the school at all. And the fact that there was an intake of 130 kids and not one of them would ever go on to even do an A-level in physics shows that there's something fundamentally wrong. And had I gone to that school, I wouldn't have been a physicist or pretended to be a physicist.
Rachel, you desperately try to get more and more young women into science.
Yes. Well,
that's
your
special concern.
Well, we've been pretty successful at the University of Melbourne in keeping young women doing science. They do start out doing science, but I think the main thing that we have learned in that process is if they understand that they can do it and that they don't have to be the best in the world, that it's enough that they love it and enjoy it, then they'll do it. And we've had remarkable success in just being quite realistic in what we teach.
What's happening in Mexico?
I want to say something not only about Mexico, but in general. Never in the history of humankind had we had so many educational resources. The internet, videos, books, home publishing. It's truly amazing the amount of resources that we have to educate young children. Never in the history of humankind has the profession of teacher been so despised globally. And you see that in the number of students they have to cope with, in the poor conditions they have to face in the classroom, in the very low salaries, in the social disregard they have for teachers worldwide. My maternal grandmother was a primary teacher, elementary school teacher. She never actually practiced it, but it was the fact that she decided to do that was extremely highly regarded in her time. Now, if a woman or a man in Mexico say, I want to become an elementary school teacher, everybody will think he or she is a failure. It's a disaster. It's a worldwide disaster, and it's something we must cope with the sooner the better.
I'd only just disagree in terms of saying it's a worldwide problem, in that my parents left India to go to England, and they could have come to Australia, but wherever they went so that their children would have a better education, and we did. But since I went to school, as I say, I think education has declined in England, whereas in India, education has improved. Now, there's huge huge problems and poverty, which means that some people don't get access to education. But the direction of progress is very positive in India, with more maths graduates being created in India than the whole of Europe, whereas the direction of change in Europe is definitely negative, and I think that's what's worrying. And why, again, we've just become lazy about the power of science. We just don't care about the value of education in the way that the previous generation possibly did.
Just want to conduct a survey of the audience, if I might, before we do the next question. How many people here had a tertiary education of any level? Bloody hell. I mean, that is astonishing, isn't it, really?
How many?
Well, I would say 95% by the look of it. Isn't that amazing? Dear, oh dear. Okay, sir, you want to... And look what it's brought you to. You're sitting here in the Elder Hall, listening to Dangerous Ideas.
Good evening. My name is Andrew Bettison. I'd just like to... share very briefly something I'm very proud of. I live in Spain. I have a 9-year-old daughter, and all of her friends at school are being educated in the Catholic values and so forth. And as a counter to that, the stuff she's been bringing home, I've told her the story of Galileo and brushed up on it and so forth. And I was extraordinarily surprised a few months ago to hear her say that when she grew up, she wanted to be a horse-riding teacher, a painter and a scientist. Scientists have become one of her heroes without my realising it. However, my question that I would like to put in is if the panel could comment on experiences that they may have had or their view on the role of philanthropy in the fostering and the development of ideas.
Well, it certainly helped a few well-known artists working painting ceilings, didn't it, Bruce? But what happens with...
Just on this idea of funding mavericks, there was a discussion last week about philanthropy in London, about philanthropy and science, and one of the participants was Mike Lazaridis. Now, Mike is the owner of the company that makes the BlackBerry. And he's made hundreds of millions of dollars out of the BlackBerry, not surprisingly. And he thought, well, what can I do with this money? I'm a very rich guy. He's an engineer. But he looked at his BlackBerry and he said, look, everything in this BlackBerry is based on fundamental physics, quantum mechanics, and so on. So I'm going to put my money back into fundamental research. And he put in $100 million into setting up the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, just outside Toronto, which is purely on speculative physics, cosmology, string theory, quantum physics, and so on. And the Canadian government's put in $100 million and so on. And it's one of the most extraordinary examples of scientific philanthropy, of somebody just saying, here's $200 million, take it and run with it, and come up with whatever you like.
There is a lot of this money coming back. A couple of the senior people they've done a lot of this, haven't they?
Yeah, and the Kavli Institutes.
The Kavli Institutes. There's also the Allen Telescope. So all the key research looking for extraterrestrial life is in fact funded out of, you know, Silicon Valley millions.
Where are you getting money for your immense project, which will see the face of God?
The Australian government.
Right.
So...
There's no philanthropic money going in? It's pretty stunted in Australia.
As far as I'm aware, in Australia, there's no major philanthropic money going into the physical sciences anyway.
It comes out of the Jewish community, the main major philanthropic trust in this country. But latterly, there is some challenge from the new money coming out of the world of cyberspace and BlackBerries.
Mm. In the last year, there's been... a lot of debate about CERN and the European Collider in Geneva, which
I think, has a budget, it may be $8 billion, maybe $80 billion, I can't remember, but it's a huge amount of money.
And you wrote a book on mathematics.
But when people said to me, is it worth $8 billion? And I said, well, first of all, it's not just the pure... Well, one, it's the pure physics. We're humans, we're curious. It's why we're here on Earth, is to understand the world around us. And we have to pay some money to get to these secrets and to become enriched culturally. Secondly, if you want hard spin-offs, imaging technology comes out of CERN and goes straight into the hospitals and saves lives. The internet, or the World Wide Web, was pioneered at CERN, which has changed economies, it's changed culture, it's changed societies. You couldn't think of a more hard-nosed benefit coming out of a pure physics research project. And although it is, I think it's $8 billion, if you spread that out over time and spread it out across the population of Europe, it's the same as a pint of beer per person per year, which for the secrets of the universe and the internet seems to me a fairly reasonable price.
I think if you asked many Australians whether they prefer the beer...
You only have to sacrifice one per year.
No, I was thinking that, listening to Rachel and to Simon, that sometimes we make a very artificial distinction between applied science and basic science, whereas there is good science or not so good science, period. Mm. And I can come out with an example I actually lived through about a month ago related to the swine flu epidemic that we had in Mexico. The virus has an RNA genome. RNA evolves about 1 million times faster than DNA. And there's one peculiar chemical change that can transform the virus from a very sensible to an anti, from a medicament to one that can be, it can become resistant. And that particular change, which involves losing an amino group and transforming cytosine into uracil, is something that I had studied with a friend of mine, Stanley Miller, about 15 years ago, trying to understand why we don't see cytosine in meteorites. We do see uracil, but we don't see cytosine. And we came out with a reaction. It was very easy to explain, and we published the paper. I mean, we went through the normal torture path that scientists have to thread. And it's something that has to do with chemistry of meteorites. They were formed 4.6 billion years ago when the solar system was collapsing, was forming. Mm-hmm. And exactly the same results can be applied to understand how a virus can become resistant to a drug. Hence, you cannot draw a definitive borderline between applied science and basic science. It's either good science or no science at all.
We're going to take a couple more questions before we wind it up. Madam, your turn.
Thank you. Philip, yes. We have great ideas in Adelaide, in Australia. But the problem, and you have touched on it a bit, is funding. I don't think there is enough philanthropy around. So if it can't be funded by Australians, it has to be part funded by overseas finance.
We do get quite a lot of philanthropy from major American trusts, like the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation, put a lot of money into Australia. Well, and I think that should shame the local tycoons, really.
Yeah. So my question was, what do you feel about this, given that China was quite keen to come in a big way and was overridden by the Rudd government? And the second part of my question is that our best and brightest young people are still leaving Adelaide either for the eastern states or overseas. And my question about that is, do you think that's necessarily in itself a bad thing?
Well, if enough of them come back, I don't think it is a bad thing, is it? Isn't now the globalisation in terms of ideas, don't you have to move around? You certainly do.
Yes, but you don't want to lose human resources. And in Mexico, for instance, and in Latin America, we're losing in a huge number of scientists, of young scientists that feel very attracted to go and stay in the United States and not coming back. What you want to have is a two-way movement. You want to have no borders, you want to have no frontiers, you want to have the people coming back and forth.
Any other comments on this poignant problem for South?
I have a comment.
Yeah.
What do all us grey power do while we're waiting for these youngsters to come back as we get to be an older and older state with less and less brilliant ideas?
That's why I find South Australia so attractive. As I get older, I'm drawn more and more to South Australia. I'm looking around.
I knew I liked you, Philip.
I'm looking around for a tomb. Sir.
Thank you. Let me compliment you on an excellent program. Simon, it was interesting hearing what you said about the BlackBerry. That company, Research in Motion, almost died at inception because of patent infringement. But it's interesting. The other thing, Simon, as well, is I read your book on chords and I really enjoyed it. Thank you for that. My question actually is to Antonio, considering your background. There was an article in today's paper about creating sperm cells from stem cells. What was your view on research like that?
Well, I haven't read the actual paper. I don't know if it's actually been published already. It's very easy if you have if you're culturing tissues to see meiosis, which is a process that will reduce the number of chromosomes in eukaryotes, and that's one of the basic steps to go into a sperm or ovula, whatever. But I think that the real issue there is a completely different one. Our current legal, ethical, economical, social systems do not know how to cope with the new discoveries in life sciences. We have absolutely no... Think, for instance, of the debate about patenting, creating patents, is that how you call it? For when you engineer a cell and create a new one. The patent laws that we have worldwide were created in the 19th century. They have absolutely nothing to do with the current situation in which you can create a system that even have properties that simulate what a living cell is. So I think that what we really need is a very open, wide, democratic discussion of how we can be able to cope with all these new discoveries. Otherwise, we will be running into blind alleys, or we will be just subject to this dogmas, like, for instance, those coming from the Catholic Church, that no, you should not experiment with stem cells and so on. I think that... We as a society, we really need to learn to cope with those new situations.
I live in hope that it will put an end to sexual intercourse because I'm told that can lead to dancing. So, one last question, thank you.
Yeah, yes, my name is Engelhard Weigel, and I'd like to emphasize an idea what is already mentioned from the panel, but I have the feeling it is not really discussed in the way which is necessary. I think great ideas, and I mean really great ideas, are coming from fundamental crises. And this idea was already mentioned, but I think it is worth to go a little bit deeper. What we get with money, what we get with better education, that is all good. But ideas which are turning around our thinking needs a bit more. And this is not what we want, because the crisis can be a crisis within the discipline. But the crisis, for example, of the Weimar Republic was an extremely dangerous crisis. But the ideas which were created during the Weimar Republic, or within the Weimar Republic, they are still not exhausted at the moment.
Does that need a response, or is it... I think it's almost complete unto itself. I think that was a very good contribution, and I'd like to now wind things up. Look, the one thing about South Australia, as you've discovered, it's a bloody smart audience, isn't it?
It is.
You wouldn't get an audience like that in Mexico City, would you?
Absolutely.
No, right. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming. I think we've got the orgasm of ideas off to a good start. And see you all tomorrow. Thank you.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.